You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Federal investigators in Monday's Amtrak crash say they want to know whether the train's engineer might have been distracted as the train sped toward an I-5 highway overpass at more than 50 miles per hour faster than the speed limit. The National Transportation Safety Board will also look at whether technology called positive train control could have prevented the derailment. Positive train control uses tech similar to GPS to prevent collisions or accidents caused by human error. A transportation official said that positive train control would be up and running when service began. It was not. So why did Amtrak open a new, faster service before all the safety measures were in place? This morning, I talked with Seattle Times reporter Mike Lindblom. He's part of a team that found that Amtrak's newer, faster route from Seattle to Portland had an aggressive timeline to begin service.
There were contracts and commitments signed by WashDOT and Sound Transit to launch the service by the end of 2017 in order to retain stimulus money from the Obama administration. The deals were signed around 2009. To upgrade this system. It's the largest and it's the centerpiece of a number of improvements worth $800 million in Western Washington. Another one listeners might be familiar with is Mukilteo. They had notorious mudslide problems that closed the Sounder North line to Everett and the Amtrak lines to Vancouver, BC. $16 million of stimulus money was spent by Burlington Northern Santa Fe to dig out and then reinforce cliffs in the Mukilteo and North Edmonds area.
So we wanted to make sure that this new route got built so we didn't lose the federal funding that we got to build the route in the first place. But what would the faster timeline mean for Amtrak's new service?
Well, the agreement with the stimulus money and the $181 million project included two more round-trip Amtrak Cascades trains per day. Those are operated by Amtrak and subsidized by WashDOT. Some of your car tab money goes to that. And they're about 60 to 70% funded by fares. It's complicated. Sound Transit owns the trackway where this crash happened. BNSF handles the dispatch. Amtrak operates the trains. And WashDOT owns the rolling stock, the Cascades.
And that complication of all of these different organizations being involved in getting this one train route to do what it needed to do is part of why you had a tough time just getting answers around what happened on Monday. Is that right?
Well, leaders of the organizations have not been answering specific questions. The CEO of Amtrak did apologize, did say that positive train control technology was important to him and that he needed to improve Amtrak's safety culture. Mr. Anderson mentioned that he had only been there a very short time and his predecessor had made some progress and he wanted to push that forward. These systems, by the way, are supposed to be fully live in Western Washington in the early part of 2018, which puts them actually ahead of most of the U.S., which is kind of a commentary on how the state of train control and safety is in the U.S.
Well, in this particular case, with this new route, why wasn't positive train control ready to go?
We don't fully know the answers as to whether they could have put it in by 2015, as Congress originally required. Congress let the deadline lapse nationwide until December 31 of 2018 under heavy lobbying by the industry. The industry and people who watch the industry think that it's a $10 billion or more investment nationally to hook up all the satellites, the in-cab technologies, the communication systems, 50 to 60-foot towers along the trackside through all these corridors. They've just said it's a very difficult proposition. Critics and watchdogs, on the other hand, said that railroads have had a freight renaissance and are making plenty of profit and could get it done sooner if they invested more money in it. In addition, technologies like this exist in many parts of the world already. That said, some of the more better-known passenger lines in the world run on their own trackway and don't share it with freight lines. The high-speed trains in Europe and Japan are running in their own corridor. It's a very complex issue. The National Transportation Safety Board has talked about it since around 1967, then again in 1993. They believe that this technology is available and could and should have been put in place many years before now.
How much longer do you think it would have taken to have all the safety features, including positive train control, up and running for this route? You mentioned that the goal is to have everything ready in Western Washington in 2018.
Yeah, I don't have the expertise to say how much sooner Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, or Amtrak could have gotten these systems activated. BNSF has said that they've installed the equipment in over 90% of Washington State on its locomotives and track sides. We'll be covering that more this week.
You also reported that there's been a lack of training for train employees when routes change, when new routes are added. Can you tell at this point how much lack of training had to do with this derailment? I mean, was this human error ultimately?
Well, I don't know how to measure how much training is enough. I've heard from a retiree who said he used to train 10 times before being qualified in a route. I don't know how many trips these guys took or required to take. That's a point that the NTSB said they were going to look at very closely. They said that there were only live trips for about 2 weeks before they had full customer service. So this is what they do is they practice under the same schedules and speeds that they would with full loads of passengers aboard, and they call it revenue service. So that was going on for about 2 weeks. There were other tests throughout the years where the trains, and probably with many of the same engineers and conductors, were going over and testing the signals and the tracks, the gates, everything along the 14.5-mile corridor. But the live practice was about 2 weeks long. I don't know yet how that compares or how much experience these guys had. That, again, that's an NTSB can pull the records, and we'll have something to say about that.
Mike, you said you're going to continue to follow this story in the coming weeks. What are the big questions you want to get answered here?
Well, why the tight curve and the old trestle across I-5 were considered okay to keep in a passenger line. That's a pretty rapid decline in speed from 80 to 30 miles an hour in a slight downhill area over a very old trestle. Was there ever an effort to get that rebuilt at a gentler angle, or perhaps was everybody depending on PTC to solve that problem, thinking that it would be, in fact, there by 2015? Remember, until very recently, Sound Transit and WashDOT believed that positive train control would be done by now. They chose to go forward anyway with the service because, after all, as Sound Transit has responded to me, it's no different than the whole rest of the state and much of the country, where they depend on signals, engineer expertise, and dispatchers to protect public safety.
Seattle Times reporter Mike Lindblom. We're tweeting out a link to his most recent story now. It's KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke.
The yeas are 227 and the nays are 203. The conference report is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
With no Democratic votes in either chamber of Congress, the Republican tax plan will make its way to the president's desk for signing. Here's what some of your Washington state representatives had to say about the bill.
The small business owners who kept telling us, we'd like to be able to pay our employees more. We'd like to be able to increase their paychecks, but it's the tax burden. It's the health care cost. And today we are standing for them.
This bill takes care of corporate special interests, the wealthy and the well-connected, while putting middle-class Americans' finances and health care on the chopping block. We need tax reform that helps middle-class families. This bill does the exact opposite.
You just heard from Washington State Congressmember Susan DelBene, a Democrat, and before that, Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican representing Spokane. But what does America's new tax plan really mean for you and me, the Washington State taxpayer? Gary Grimstad has been an accountant in Washington State for more than 30 years, and he's a part-time lecturer in the University of Washington's Foster School. Hi, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So you just heard Republican Congressmember Kathy McMorris Rogers say this new tax plan will be good for small business, reduce the tax burden, allow them to pay employees more. Then Representative Susan DelBene and other Democrats have said this is going to hurt middle class families. Do you agree with either of those claims?
Well, I think both of them are probably accurate. There is a provision in the new tax law that for small businesses, and many small businesses are run so that the income from the small business actually flows through to the individual tax return of the owner. And under the new tax law, there's up to a 20% deduction for the business income that's coming onto the individual's tax return. So that should theoretically save them some money in the long run. Now, of course, like everything in the tax law, there are exceptions and those types of things. But overall, I think small business people should see a reduction in the tax owing to the federal government. The middle income, from what I've been able to determine, middle income families will probably initially get about a $1,200 per year tax reduction. But the issue we have with most of the individual provisions is that they sunset or they end after the 2025 tax filing season.
So we'll see a little bit more money, but that goes away.
But that goes away right. over time. That is correct.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we've heard that this plan will be particularly bad for blue states like Washington State. So how will this tax plan affect blue states?
Well, probably the biggest downside for the blue states such as Washington State is that there is now a cap on the amount of state and local taxes that can be deducted on an individual's tax return if they itemize their deductions. And whereas before, under present law, let's just take an example that a Washington State resident paid $10,000 in property taxes and let's say $7,000 in state sales taxes, they could deduct, if they itemize their deductions, the entire $17,000 of property taxes and sales taxes that they paid. Under the new tax law starting January 1st of 2018, that same taxpayer would be limited or capped to only being able to deduct $10,000 of that total $17,000 amount paid for property taxes and sales tax in the state of Washington.
Okay. Well, one of the things that's unusual about Washington State is we don't have a state income tax. Does this new federal tax plan de-incentivize ever getting a state income tax here?
I would certainly think so, yes, because one of the advantages is that if we had a state income tax, if you want to call it an advantage, is that there was the ability to deduct whatever state income tax you paid on your federal income tax return. Now that's basically taken away, and unless they reduce our property taxes and our sales tax, along with instigating an income tax, most people would not be able to deduct any of the increase in taxes that they would pay to the state of Washington.
I'm talking with Gary Grimstad. He's been an accountant in Washington State for the last 30 years. He's also a part-time lecturer at the University of Washington. And Gary, the president called this new tax plan a Christmas present for the American people. So what kind of change will people see in their paychecks in 2018?
Well, again, I think that the average savings for middle America is going to be about $1,200 a year. So technically, they should get an increase in their monthly cash flow of about $100. Now, the question is since the law was passed so late in the year, the IRS is going to have to scramble to get new withholding tables put together. So it's my understanding that most people will probably not see the benefit of the lower tax rates until probably February or March of next year.
We asked some of our listeners on Facebook to weigh in with any questions that they have about this tax bill as well. And Rebecca asked, I'm a nonprofit fundraiser, so what made it into the final bill regarding deductible donations to 501c3s?
Well, actually, there's a little bit of good news there. Under present law, a taxpayer, if they make a cash distribution to a charitable organization, can only deduct up to 50% of their adjusted gross income. And adjusted gross income is, if you look at the first page of your tax return, it's generally the last number that you would see on page one of your tax return. So let's say someone has $100,000 of AGI. Under present law,
what's AGI? Annual gross income?
Adjusted gross income.
Thank you.
Adjusted gross income.
I was close.
So yeah, you were. So if they have $100,000 under present law, they could deduct up to $50,000 of cash contributions to a 501c3 organization, charitable organization. Under the new tax law, that goes up to 60%. So they could basically deduct up to $60,000 of charitable contributions. So that's the good news for charitable organizations. The bad news is that because the standard deduction has been almost doubled for all types of taxpayers, many more taxpayers will not be itemizing deductions and will just be taking the standard deduction. So if one of the incentives for individuals is to make a charitable deduction to get a deduction on their tax return, for many people that incentive may go away because they're not itemizing deductions anymore. They're taking the standard deduction.
Okay. Well, another possible piece of good news, House Speaker Paul Ryan said this tax bill was meant to simplify the tax code and we were going to be able to file our taxes on a postcard. So is that happening? Can we now file our taxes on a postcard, Gary?
You cannot. And just remember that, the tax law itself that we're talking about is over 500 pages long. And I don't see the only real simplification I see in this whole bill is that there will be more people that will be able to use the standard deduction versus itemizing, but you certainly will not be able to do it on a postcard.
Okay. Well, Gary Grimstad, an accountant in Washington State for more than 30 years, part-time lecturer in the UW Foster School of Business, thank you for walking us through what this new tax bill might do for us.
You're very welcome and have a great day.
You too. This is The Record. On Monday morning, when the Amtrak Cascades train derailed near DuPont, I was in Nebraska with my family. I learned about the derailment because my dad started reading Facebook posts about it out loud to me. So then, to learn more, I immediately got on Facebook and Twitter as well. Not a traditional news source like the Seattle Times or KUOW, even though I work for KUOW, I got on social media. Those social media platforms are designed to keep us looking, to keep us responding. New York University professor Scott Galloway calls social media platforms weaponized. His latest book is called The Four: The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And back in October, Galloway told Bill Radke that the business model of The Four is frictionless. And that's a problem.
Anyone with a credit card, anyone who's built a following, whether it's a legitimate following under the auspices of who you are or maybe a fake identity, can get a certain amount of scale really quickly without any sort of friction or editorial checks on the veracity. So it was only a matter of time. I think it's the tip of the iceberg, and we're going to slowly uncover a lot more fake news than we thought was out there. The onion's being peeled back here, and the stench gets worse and worse.
You think that Facebook and Google are about to be hit with major government regulation. Is that right? And why do you say that?
Yeah. So I believe the worm has turned in terms of what I would call this gross idolatry of big tech over the last 10 years, where everyone was sort of – the only argument was who was more Jesus-like among the CEOs. So you've seen kind of the perfect storm, whether it's sort of the cultural problems that Uber was having, fines coming out of Europe. Most recently, it looks as if Facebook and Twitter have been weaponized by entities affiliated with the Russian government. And I think that in concert with job destruction, income inequality, I think the worm has turned and you're going to see some form of either regulation or, more likely, the mother of all fines. However, I don't think it's going to come out of Washington. I think it's likely going to come out of Brussels. And the reason for that is that here in the U.S., we register tremendous benefit from these companies in terms of economic growth, in terms of charity, in terms of real estate values. They recruit tons of kids out of my class at NYU. But Europe doesn't register as much of the upside, but gets as much downside in terms of job destruction, in terms of fake news, things like that, which is stiffening their backbone. You're going to see the first $10 billion-plus fine come out of Europe against one or more of the four.
Well, as you say, a European antitrust fine is not the same as American regulation. What do you expect on that front?
In terms of American regulation?
Mm-hmm.
To be blunt, I don't see it happening in the short term. I don't think this administration has the will nor the collective IQ. I don't think there's anyone in the administration that has the technology acumen to take on the four. I think the administration going after the four would be Mayweather-McGregor part two, and that is the redhead gets the crap kicked out of them. I just don't think they have the bandwidth, the resources, or the understanding of technology to take on the four.
Again, when you say the four, we're talking about Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google. And up to now, we've been talking about Facebook and Google and fake news. What about Amazon and Apple when it comes to regulation?
So Amazon's a very interesting one because most regulation is based on, or most antitrust regulation is based on the notion that what's good for the consumer is always good for society. And it usually the proxy for that is share or share of market. And Amazon has competitors in every category it competes in. And it'd be very hard to argue that Amazon has been anything but great for the consumer. The issue is there's some pretty uncomfortable questions if you really start thinking about Amazon's dominance. The first is it's attained, I believe, a $500 billion market capitalization, fourth or fifth most in the world, and has paid $1.4 billion in corporate income tax since 2008 versus $64 billion for Walmart. So the question of if the most successful companies in the world aren't paying taxes, how do we pay our firefighters and our soldiers? You also have a company now that is so dominant and is so fawned over by the media that it can perform what I would refer to as Jedi mind tricks, and that is between the time it purchased or announced the acquisition of Whole Foods and when it closed, Kroger, the largest pure-play grocer in the nation, lost a third of its value. Keep in mind, Whole Foods is only 1/11 the size of Kroger. So what we have is a company that can literally look at another industry, put out press releases, and take 10 to 30% of the value off of that industry. We've never seen anything like this. And the question is, and the big question surrounding Amazon and all these companies will be a fundamental one as it relates to antitrust, and that is what is always good for the consumer, is that always good for society?
You brought up the example of taxes. Why is it that Amazon paid 1/64th or 1/60th of what Walmart paid in federal income taxes?
Well, nothing illegal. They invest all of their money back into the company. They run the company at break even. And that's what's so interesting about Amazon, is that unlike the other or the rest of, unlike Facebook, Google, or Apple, Amazon has decided to run their business at break-even and has literally changed the relationship of the compact with the investment markets in that it has replaced profits with vision and growth. So as a result, they're able to invest more. They're able to operate their business at a much lower margin and offer a consumer value proposition that is very difficult for anybody else to compete with. Mickey Drexler, the former CEO of J. Crew, summarized it perfectly when he said, how do you compete with a company that doesn't want to be profitable? So we have this company, the analogy I would use is a war analogy. At the end of World War II, the Germans had better morale, better machinery, but the Allies had 38 gallons of gasoline for every one they had because we had cut off their distribution and supply routes. Amazon is the company that shows up to any business with 38 gallons of gasoline because of its access to extraordinarily cheap capital, because in the investment community's mind, tomorrow never becomes today in terms of expectations. They've been able to run a break even and have their stock price go up and up and up and have access to the credit markets where they can now borrow money at a lower rate than China. So they can show up to non-core industries and overnight be a formidable player. We've just never seen this before.
Well, as you say, investors like Amazon, consumers like Amazon. You gave the example of Kroger, but the government is not necessarily in the business of protecting companies who maybe they have an outdated business model. I'll ask you the question you posed, which is, who's hurt?
It's a fair question, and it warrants a discussion. But I think there's a lot of brands, a lot of CPG companies, a lot of small companies, a lot of e-commerce companies. I mean, look at the world of e-commerce. There's one e-commerce company that's successful, and it's Amazon. And any category that Amazon goes into, by looking at their marketplace and examining the profitability, can then go into that category and offer that service at a lower price than anybody else, which is great for the consumer. It's great for Seattle real estate holders. It's great for Amazon shareholders. But is it good for the business ecosystem? And I think that's the fundamental question we have to wrestle with. And then the second big question is, if the most successful companies in the world adopt this winner-take-all, zero-profitability model and don't pay any meaningful corporate income tax, doesn't that just mean that the less successful companies have to pay more? I think we have some serious, very interesting conversations ahead of us.
You wrote that these four companies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, that they manipulate our fundamental emotional needs in a way that other companies can't match. That's interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, since 2008, these companies have added more market capitalization than the GDP of India. And I believe that these companies tap into a very basic sort of lizard brain-like instinct, and that's why they enjoy mass adoption on a kind of a multi-billion person scale. I think Google is our modern man's god. As we become more educated and affluent, we are less dependent upon church. But our need for a super being only grows with modern-day anxieties. So anyone who's had kids prays whenever their kid is not doing well. Will my kid be all right? In today's age, we now go to Google and we type in symptoms and treatment of croup. 1 in 6 queries posed to Google have never been asked before. I don't think any priest, rabbi, scholar, coach, mentor, boss has that kind of credibility where 1 in 6 questions presented to that person have never been asked before. So Google is filling that void or that need that we have had as a species for a super being. Facebook is love, our ability to connect and reinforce our connections with photography and pictures. Our need as a species not only to be loved, but to love others. I think Facebook taps immediately into that. Amazon is our gut. We need nutrients. We need to take in stuff. We need to digest it. The penalty for too little stuff was starvation. And that's been a terrible malady for our species for millions of years. So you open your cupboard, you open your closet, you have 10 to 100 times more than what you actually need. More for less is a business strategy that's never gone out of style. It's the strategy that Walmart, China, and Amazon employ. Amazon is our gut. And then moving further down the torso, Apple is our reproductive organs. It targets our genitalia in terms of making us more attractive to the other mate. The feathers, if you will, of success used to be a high-end watch or a purse or a nice pair of shoes. The Apple iOS says that you're part of the innovation class, you live in a city, you're wealthy, you can afford the best, and you have better genes, and it signals attractiveness to other mates. And as a result, Apple, no accident, offers the same operating margins of an Hermes or a Ferrari because it appeals to our instinct to want to be more attractive to the other sex.
Scott Gallows is going right up your body, your reproductive organs, your gut, your heart, and then the super being above it all. And he writes about the big four. And you wrote that that Amazon is the one. Those are the four, and that Amazon is the one. Your piece, at least the headline writer, called it Amazon Takes Over the World. Forget about the other tech giants. Amazon is poised to beat them all. We're in Seattle, where Amazon's growth has been a great thing. Is it wrong for Seattleites to feel otherwise?
Oh, no. I'm proud of Amazon. I think it's an incredible company. 10 years ago, the number one recruiter from my class at NYU was American Express. Now the number one recruiter is Amazon. It's an incredible company. I think it raises interesting questions, and I think we should have those discussions, but there's just no getting around it. I own 3 stocks, Amazon, Apple, and Nike. And as a consumer, it brings tremendous utility. The question is, at some point, and I think this is true of all four, I think we engage in a gross idolatry of innovators. And I don't believe these four firms play by the same rules as other firms. I think the old media, including NPR, has basically served as the outsourced investor relations group or department for these companies, just talking about how amazing they are. And as a result, I don't think they play by the same rules. I think if the terrorists in San Bernardino had been carrying a BlackBerry, there wouldn't have been any argument about busting into their phone. I don't think other big firms can engage in the same type of tax avoidance as Apple. I don't think other firms that would be destroying jobs or not paying taxes like Amazon would enjoy the hall pass that Amazon gets. I think we have some very interesting discussions ahead of us.
So when we ask personally, what can I do about X, whatever the thing is I'm worried about, your personal answer is buy their stock.
Oh, I don't know about that. No,
own their stock.
That's unfair. I think just to be engaged and be part of the dialogue and recognize that these companies are fantastic companies, but they're companies, and their job is to be profitable and show a return to their shareholders, full stop. They're not concerned with the condition of our souls. They're not going to take care of us when we're older. And so we should look at them as companies and nothing more. And I feel that sometimes we look at them as a religion. I think Apple literally has taken on religious values. I think Steve Jobs is kind of a innovator's Jesus Christ, and they shouldn't call it the iPhone X. They should call it the iPhone Cross. I think the iPhone has taken on sort of the symbolic deity-like, crucifix-like meaning in our lives.
We're talking with author Scott Galloway. The book is The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And a listener, as we're talking, tweeted to us, Tim tweets, why isn't Microsoft included? Which does, I'm not sure what all was behind Tim's question, but it does make you, it reminds us that Microsoft used to be considered unstoppable too.
Yeah, and to be fair, when guys like me start saying companies are unstoppable, it usually signals that they're about to go into structural decline.
Right.
But having said that, I do think those four, I think the only thing in the way of them and a $1 trillion market cap is themselves or the perception that they're poor citizens and regulation. I get asked all the time why I haven't included Microsoft. And the kind of the scripted answer is that the other four are more B2C and Microsoft is B2B. But the honest answer is
What does that mean, B2C, B2B? Well, business to consumer?
Yeah, business to business versus business to consumer. Yeah. Most people who purchase Microsoft are working at companies, or the majority of the revenues come from other businesses as opposed to consumers, even though you could argue that the majority of revenues from Facebook come from businesses. Look, the honest answer is I don't understand Microsoft as well as I understand the other four, and so I didn't include it. But if you would extend the metaphor of your person, Microsoft would clearly be work and our need to work and our need to feel productive and our need to provide economic value and productivity. And arguably over the last 24 months, maybe with the exception of Amazon, Microsoft has been the best performing. Stocks at an all-time high. I mean, Seattle listeners, you're probably the home to the two most impressive companies of the last 24 months. So in terms of just sheer performance, impact, kind of adult supervision in terms of management and market capitalization, it'd be hard to exclude Microsoft from those four. So your listener's question is the correct one.
And when you talk to Seattle area listeners, Scott, first I heard you say think differently. Don't buy the God image. These are just companies that don't have your best interest at heart. Is there anything you want listeners to you right now to do differently?
That's a really interesting question. I would say engage in the dialogue and be thoughtful around our elected officials. And if at some point, we no longer worship at the altar of kindness and character. We worship at the altar of innovation. And it worries me that this gross idolatry of youth and innovators is resulting in some negative outcomes where companies can be weaponized by foreign adversaries because they have the mother of all hall passes and they don't endure the same scrutiny as every other company endures.
That's Scott Galloway, author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. He talked with Bill Radke earlier this year. This is The Record. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. During the last 2 weeks of December alone, 2.5 million people will move through SeaTac Airport. In 2016, SeaTac became the 9th busiest airport in the world. But sometimes getting planes off the ground can be complicated.
This past June, a heat wave swept through the Southwest. Nothing new, right? This time, it was so hot that airplanes couldn't take off. In Phoenix, temperatures hit 119 degrees Fahrenheit and dozens of flights were canceled. Hotter weather makes for thinner air, so airlines had to drop weight by paying their customers to give up their seats or delay flights until it cooled off later in the day. It was one of those moments where it feels like nature might be trying to tell us something.
Nature might be trying to tell us something. Ashley Ahern has spent a lot of time thinking about this, about nature and airplane travel, for her latest episode of the Environment podcast, Terrestrial. Hi, Ashley.
Hello, Jeannie.
So in the episode, you talk with a woman named Janice who decided she needed to stop flying. Why?
Yes. Janice Ray. She's a beautiful, such a talented writer, and she's a longtime environmental activist. And so she was making her living traveling around the country, giving talks and book signings and living the life, right? The jet-setting author life. And then she had this moment where she went to give a talk. She was, kind of came in for the day and was sitting about to go up. And there was a board member at this college that is, prides itself on being very sustainability minded, environmental focused. And she realized that so many people in the room had flown in just for this one thing. And she just kind of had this moment where she was like, holy crap, we're speaking out of two sides of our mouths here. We're not walking the walk. And so she decided to give up flying.
Hmm.
And she hasn't been on a plane in 10 years.
We're not walking the walk, meaning none of us have considered the carbon footprint of all of the flights that we took just to get here for the day.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for many Americans, airplane travel is one of the top three contributors to their carbon footprint annually.
Hmm. Well, when you were talking with Denise, what struck you the most about her story? She sounds like a pretty fascinating woman.
She is. First of all, she has the most amazing accent. She is from Georgia. But that I think what surprised me about her is that she grew up in poverty. She has not enjoyed, you know, privilege her entire life. And I think that it's a privilege to even think about a lot of the environmental questions that we try to unpack in this podcast. And I think that, you know, she comes at it from the sense of you learn how to make do with less. She talks about her parents who run a junkyard in Georgia where she grew up as like people who are probably living the most environmental ethic you could live in terms of reusing, you know, like, and not flying. They've never been on commercial airplanes, she says. So for her, I think that this decision was a very conscious environmentally, you know, it came from her environmental ethics. She went away to college and started reading Wendell Berry. And, you know, she's a big fan of Bill McKibben. And so she has all of the environmental street cred in the environmental movement. But she comes from such a surprising background, you know, fundamentalist Christian upbringing, rural, agricultural, poor, and still made this really surprising choice.
Well, you talked a little bit about some of the puzzle pieces that sort of got her to be thinking about environmentalism, reading Bill McKibben, Wendell Berry, those kinds of things. But how did she go from growing up in, I mean, a junkyard in Georgia to becoming an environmentalist writer and speaker? How did that happen?
Well, so her dad didn't finish high school, but he really wanted his kids to have a formal education. And so he, you know, she went to college in Florida and then she went on and got an MFA. And so she's was living in Vermont and kind of traveling around. And I think that, you know, there she was exposed to environmentalist thinking, writing in academia. But she didn't let go of her roots. And I think that the realization that she needed to give up flight came in part from a feeling of disconnect with her sense of place and where she'd come from.
Well, and eventually, and this was something that surprised me in the episode, Janice decided to move back home.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I kept asking her that. I was like, well, no, actually, I started like you. I said, well, why did you leave? You know, what got you out of Georgia? And she was like, well, the better question is actually, why did I go back? And so 9 years ago, she and her husband decided that they had lost touch with her people and her part of the world and where she came from. And she's from, you know, her family goes back generations in this one part of Georgia. And so she, you know, used her money and bought a farm and lives, you know, not far from her parents and also not far from a train line. So she uses, you know, takes the train and she can get to New York, you know, by the following day if she gets on a train in Jessup, Georgia. And so she's sort of said that she's, through making this decision, has been able to reconnect with her own roots and her own sense of place. And I think I went into this episode thinking, well, this is about carbon footprints and environmental impact, and it's actually about relationships and people and where we come from and how we lose that connection. And it's not to say airplanes are a bad thing. God, I wouldn't be able to live here if it weren't for airplanes. My family is all back in Boston. So, like, I am so grateful for this innovation, but I also know that it comes with a cost, and that's kind of what we're trying to wrestle with in Terrestrial.
I'm talking with Ashley Ahern. She hosts KUOW's environment podcast, Terrestrial. And as we've been discussing, this latest episode is about a woman who stops flying and eventually moves back to her hometown. And we asked listeners how their lives would change if they stopped flying, including listeners who are part of the Terrestrial Facebook group. And Craig, who's part of the Terrestrial Facebook group, wrote this: I'd see my friends and family much less or not at all, kind of like you, Ashley. And then he basically attempts to solve the problem. He says, what we need to do is reconfigure our mass transit to run on trains and ships, and people need longer paid vacations to accommodate the longer travel times. Problem solved. What do you think, Ashley?
We love you, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
I mean, I think Craig, he's made some comments in the group that I think are really smart and interesting, pointing the finger at the system, right? That the system doesn't make it easy for us to make these, quote unquote, better or lower carbon choices. And I think that that's really a question that is at the core of so much environmental thought, that, like, do we take the blame personally as, like, it's my fault for flying on airplanes, or is it the fault of the system that makes it impossible for me to take the train where I need to get to in this country? I don't have the answer to that question. I love that, you know, for some people, it's a very simple, like, externalize it, it's the system. For others, it's a deeply personal, heart-wrenching, guilt-inducing problem whether or not they personally get on an airplane to see their families. Probably most of us are somewhere in the middle, and we're just trying to get by, and we're just trying to see our families over the holidays and, like, maintain our relationships.
Well, that idea of the system being the problem, one of the things that surprised me in the episode was a conclusion that Janice draws, which is that this system of travel, that flying, it's like it's like an achievement, an accomplishment, mm-hmm. right? If we jet set all over the place, if we fly all over the place, that says something about who we are, how important we are, you know, how busy we are, all of that. That's not something that I considered about flying. Was there anything in this episode that caused you to think a little bit differently about air travel?
I mean, looking through my Facebook feed or social media feed, sure, I have so many friends that talk about their MVP status and having to jet and then like posting awesome pictures from wherever they are around the world when they go to these awesome places. And like, I travel so much for work too and for family. So I am completely guilty as charged. And the point of the show is never to be like pointing the finger, making people feel bad. It's just to kind of be exploring ideas. Did it change me personally? I mean, the terrestrial production team, like my editor's in Maine and our sound designer is in LA. So like we're all remote and we meet on Slack and we have phone calls and conference calls every week. Like we're not flying in to see each other more than once a year, I would say, maybe twice. So trying to be conscious of that, but also acknowledging that for so many people, they wouldn't have a job. They wouldn't have a livelihood if they couldn't fly. And also that this city is fascinating right now. The Puget Sound region, as it booms, like so many people are moving here from elsewhere and they're leaving behind family. And that's a luxury, that's a class thing, that we have the privilege to relocate and take jobs in foreign places or faraway cities and still be able to go home and see our parents. So I don't mean to throw shade on that by any means. I think it's an interesting part of our modern lives that is changing our family relationships.
Well, we have a lot more responses from listeners on Facebook to this question, what would your life look like if you stopped flying? And Ariel points out, this question is assuming you have the means to travel mm-hmm. by air in the first place. Again, the privilege question, right? KUOW listeners may, but work trips, academic conferences, interstate or international vacations are not the norm for all Americans. What do you think about that? You're nodding along as
yeah.
what Ariel has to say.
And that's why we featured Janice, because I did not want to... I wanted to show that this is a choice that everyone can make, but not everyone comes from the same place of privilege of being able to make that choice or having to face that choice even. But it does raise the question for me about in the larger climate conversation that oftentimes the wealthy are the developed nations are the biggest culprits when it comes to CO2 emissions per capita or as a country. And so I think that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, right? Like that means that we should be asking these questions. We should be thinking about this stuff because, yeah, we have the privilege to be flying, many of us, many KOW listeners. And that I think requires a certain amount of reflection.
Well, I wanted to get back to Janice, who's in this episode. She talked a little bit about relationships, the same thing that you came to realize this episode was about, and you know, the cost that we pay when we live far away from our families and our hometowns.
Modern life requires of us to be so fragmented. We leave the places we love. Most of us leave the family we love. So I think we give up a lot of things that I think are essential to leading good lives, essential to our humanity.
So you said before your family lives on the other side of the country. My family lives in the Midwest. I just flew back from seeing them earlier this mm-hmm. week. What did this episode show you about how our relationships with our families and our hometowns change when we only can get to them by airplane?
It was really interesting. I was surprised at how much it kind of hit me personally. So my parents split up after 33 years of marriage in the last like 2 years. And so every time I go home, my three siblings are all home. They live within 40 miles of my parents. And so they're living this every day and they're finding the healing through the small interactions, walking the dogs together, like spending time with my dad, you know, meeting my mom's new boyfriend, these kinds of things that just like help you heal from a big change in your family. And I fly home maybe twice a year and I parachute in for a couple days and it's hard every time, right? Like you relive the pain of that every time. And it's new. Whereas, you know, my brother kind of called me out on it. And he was like, you come home and like you try to get everybody together and have these big dinners and you want to see everyone when you're home. And the truth is we're all getting by in our own ways and we don't want to have those big dinners. Like let's spend some real quality time when you're home instead of this sort of like the high pressure, intense flying in for like these family connections that I miss and I yearn for just like everyone else does in their families. And it's fundamentally different. And I think if I was there, if I wasn't on the other side of the country, I'd probably be adjusting every day as opposed to having it sort of abruptly resurfaced every time I fly home. So that was just a personal reflection that I wasn't expecting in putting together this episode. But I think that maybe my family relationships would be better if I was closer to my parents. Yeah, like and my siblings.
Or, I mean, I hadn't thought about this either, but maybe we need to adjust our expectations of what a relationship looks like when we live so far away from people. It's certainly what I'll be thinking about as I Skype with my parents on Christmas morning instead of spending actual time with them.
Yeah, I'm not going to be home for Christmas either, so.
Terrestrial host Ashley Ahern, thank you so much for coming in. I really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
She's the host, as I mentioned, of the environment podcast Terrestrial, and we are tweeting out a link to the latest episode. And to subscribe, do so now. This is The Record. The U.S. government and the British Columbia government have both taken decisive action on grizzly bears. Totally different decisive actions. The Trump administration has halted efforts to bring grizzly bears back to the North Cascades. The British Columbia government, meanwhile, has enacted a near total ban on hunting grizzlies. Vaughn Palmer with the Vancouver Sun, you suspect the BC hunting ban might be to placate environmentalists who are actually mad about something else. Is that right? What's going on there?
I think the timing is a factor, Jeannie. Last week on the show with Bill, I talked about how the BC government had angered a lot of environmentalists by deciding to complete construction of a huge hydroelectric dam on the Peace River in northeastern BC. They been thought they might put a halt to it. Instead, they're going to complete the dam. And environmentalists didn't like it. Some First Nations didn't like it either. So the government this week, one week after that original announcement, announced a ban total, near total, on hunting grizzly bears in the province. So First Nations people who have a constitutional right to hunt for food and ceremonial purposes will continue to be able to hunt, but that's a relatively small number of people. A number of First Nations have also joined the ban. The main ban, however, is province-wide, and it basically means an end of trophy hunting and an end even of hunting grizzly bears for food.
How controversial has trophy hunting of grizzlies been in BC?
It's been growing in controversy over the last few years. I think the cabinet minister in charge who announced the ban this week said it's not socially acceptable to British Columbians to hunt this iconic species anymore. It's interesting, provincial government scientists have been monitoring the hunt for years, and they say the number of bears that were being killed every year was not large enough to put the species at risk. There's about 15,000 grizzly bears in British Columbia, and about 300 were being hunted every year, so that was not a threat to the survival of the species. We had a report this fall that said the biggest threat to the survival of the species is loss of habitat owing to logging and development of the province. So it's not a conservation measure. It is a political measure driven by growing public outrage. It is just not acceptable to be trophy hunting grizzly bears. It's a pretty lucrative business, by the way. If you want to hunt a grizzly bear in British Columbia, it can cost you $20,000 to get the Guide Outfitter Association to take you out and take you out on a hunt. And of course, there's no guarantee you'll actually get a bear, but it's big business, trophy hunting, but it is no longer a business that is going to be tolerated in British Columbia.
And the ban was immediate, right?
Yeah, it takes effect right away. There will be no more, as I said, other than a few dozen, perhaps, every year, hunted by First Nations people who still hunt in the traditional way. One of the other things that's changed is that some First Nations people, some native British Columbians, were essentially providing a kind of cover for foreign hunters. So you would have a native guide, a native company that would take you out, and you would be able to get a bear that way. That isn't going to be allowed anymore either. The native people will be allowed to hunt for their own purposes, but they won't be allowed to essentially contract out their right to hunt to a foreigner or to a British Columbian who wants to do it, for that matter.
Well, Vaughn, what's the response been so far to this ban? I mean, are environmentalists pleased?
Oh, yeah. No, this is the comment was an early Christmas present. Most of the people who spoke out against the hydroelectric dam decision last week have come out and praised the government this week. And that's why I think the timing isn't coincidental. The Guide Outfitters Association of British Columbia, they're the people that, you know, it's a business for them, trophy hunting. They've come out very, very angry and said this is not based on science. This is essentially the government caving to a majority opinion, but a majority opinion that's held in the big cities, not necessarily in rural British Columbia. The government says that it will assist the businesses to make the transition. They've ruled out complete compensation, but they say they will help them make the transition. And, of course, there are other species that you can hunt in British Columbia. You can hunt deer, you can hunt caribou, elk. Some of those species are fairly limited hunting as well, but moose. But there will still be hunting and trophy hunting in British Columbia, just no longer grizzly bears. The other thing, of course, is there's a growing business in BC of ecotourism. You know, you can go out and take pictures of grizzly bears. There are people that will take you out and see them. There are viewing areas. You can go watch them fishing in the rivers. So there is a growing ecologically sound business involving the bears. And the government says in the long run, they think that's probably a bigger business than the hunting was anyway.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thank you so much, as always.
Bye-bye, Jeannie.
Bye-bye. And that's The Record today. Thanks for listening. Our show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimwa-Bramkong. I just totally messed up your name, Ajua. I'm so sorry about that, but you do amazing work with us. Bon Huberman and Jason Pagano. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thank you for listening.